When I embarked on this endeavour to produce a podcast called In the Arena, I must admit my first thought was always that it was going to be people who I'd got to know, who I'd spent time with, who had been literally in the arena as it's spoken about, particularly the sporting arena. And then through just a series of circumstances, our business manager, Belinda Tui, found herself in the Galapagos on a trip of a lifetime. And one of the people she got to meet there was Dame Alison Rose, DBE, who, as she soon learned, and a very, from what my experience of her, and certainly Belinda's, an unbelievably humble person. But up until recently, she was actually the CEO, the first woman to hold this role, as of NatWest Group, which is a company with an operating revenue, which I believe of $6 billion, assets of $693 billion, 61,000 employees and 19 million customers. So that is well and truly in the arena. And then when trying to find that place where our lives in one way or another could intersect, we found ourselves in this really generous conversation. And it was, she went very quickly to her experience in sport and how she used that experience in this case as a cox in a rowing team, which she drew upon for the rest of her time as a CEO. This is a wonderful conversation and I was just so privileged to have had it. It was also the first time we've used the technology across many kilometres between ourselves and London. So there are a few little technical hitches within it all, but I think we've been able to iron most of those out. But this is a wonderful conversation with a wonderful person, and I was just so privileged to have it. So welcome into the arena, Dame Alison Rose, DBE.
Well, first of all, I'd like to welcome you. I've never introduced a dame before. It's so Dame Alison. I did grow up with dames and sirs. I'm of a generation which is old enough that Australians, we did have our dames and sirs, but they were normally, like, it was Dame Nellie Melba, who was a famous opera singer, and Sir Donald Bradman, who was a famous cricketer. So that was sort of our names of it. So how do I address you in this moment? How does that work?
So I think Alison will be just fine.
Yeah, cool. I'm sure you get asked that question a lot. And one of the things I'm always interested in, and I love the concept of a Because story, because I think people connect by finding common ground in regard to our Because story. So, and I love a Because story because it almost connects our story so far with our story not yet. And the sort of the two things which jumped out at me in regard to your so far story is firstly the championing of women in leadership, but more specifically, championing of women in entrepreneurship, but also how someone with a history background ends up becoming a CEO of a major bank or one of the biggest banks in the world. So, and they may cross over in some shape or form, but I'll be really interested in just learning a little bit more about you from that perspective.
Sure. So, yeah, I studied history as my degree, and I mean, I studied history because it was a topic I loved. I had a very fantastic history teacher, like most people, but really inspired by an amazing history teacher, Polish chap called Mr. Bonczek, and he persuaded me to do history. And then when I was coming to the end of my degree and trying to decide what I wanted to do, I really looked at what a job would give me rather than a career would give me, rather than sort of the what was the role description written down. I grew up all around the world. My father was in the military, so I loved travel. I loved living abroad. I knew I didn't want to go into the army. That seemed to be the family profession. I looked for a job that would give me the opportunity to travel, that would, you know, I'm very competitive. I played a lot of sports, so that was a competitive environment, you know, bright people, interesting people. And I liked business, and that sort of led me into banking. And joining a graduate scheme, probably my initial thoughts were I would do it for 3 or 4 years, figure out what I liked about it, get to travel, probably go back to Asia. And that was really how it started. There was no grand sort of plan of becoming a banker, becoming a CEO. It was really that initial period. And then, like most people at that age, you start and you learn and you learn and you learn and your career unfolds in front of you. So that was really history into banking. My focus on women's leadership and female entrepreneurship, women's leadership was really came about mainly when I joined banking. I mean, and even today, it's still a very male-dominated environment. But I didn't, you know, I joined with lots of women. There were other female graduates, not as many as the men. But I got to a point in my career where I kind of looked around and all the men had disappeared. And as I became more senior, I realized, you know, I was pretty much on my own. And the role models that were there at the age I was starting were not role models that I could recognize. And so it became really important to me that I think as a senior woman, you have a responsibility to help the women coming behind you. So I became and remain a very big advocate of supporting women. And also, I think recognizing that leadership comes in many different forms. There was a very, when I started my career, cookie cutter view of what success looked like, what a successful leader looked like. None of that fitted me. And so I think being able to encourage that was really important. And then female entrepreneurship was an extension of that, but was very business focused. I was running part of the bank. One of my first executive roles was supporting commercial banking and entrepreneurs. And what I found was there was this massive gap. We did some research and we saw that, you know, 47% of people who wanted to start a business and become an entrepreneur, and entrepreneurs are kind of the lifeblood of any economy, didn't do it because they didn't know where to get to go to get help or didn't have the right support. And so for me, it felt a great place that the bank could be helpful in my role. And then as we built a network of accelerators, you know, I found, you know, the environment I created, almost half the entrepreneurs who were coming into those accelerators were women. But when you looked at the statistics outside in the broader economy, that wasn't true. And it was a terrible experience for female entrepreneurs. So both, you know, my support for recognizing as a female leader, leadership sometimes looks different to the perception of old style approaches. Same in entrepreneurship and business. So for me, it was about putting proactive, practical help in place to help female entrepreneurs. And there was this massive untapped potential. The research we did through a piece of work I did with the Treasury said that there was £250 billion contribution that could be added to the UK economy at a time where there was lack of productivity and lack of growth, if we could just help those female entrepreneurs get the support and help they needed. It wasn't that they didn't have great business ideas. It wasn't that there weren't female entrepreneurs. It's just they weren't getting the right environment to thrive. And that to me felt both a hardcore business economic reason to put the right support measures in, but also as a woman sort of to help recognize that you support women in all aspects as a senior leader.
Yeah, and it's almost intuitively you'd think the opposite. You'd think as an entrepreneur, what we're actually doing is backing the idea. It's about the idea, regardless of where the idea actually comes from. And then to actually have an experience, which is something different to that. And that's why I thought that little point of difference was an important one, that I think we, you know, the world hopefully and slowly is getting its head around the importance of, you know, diversity in relation to what we bring to the table from a decision-making perspective, particularly from a leadership point of view, given that we are all operating in a place of ambiguity anyway. So different views are very important if we're dealing in ambiguity, and which I think is basically the role of leaders, to be honest.
Yeah.
But my first sense was when I saw the difference and I started to study the work that you've done, was that point of difference, whereas I just always assumed that what we do as entrepreneurs is we just support the idea. But there's obviously other forms of bias which are coming in, and obviously other layers in regard to, you know, home support, all those types of things, which I'm sure, you know, add layers of complexity to it. And but to actually go into that space, one, it's sort of obvious in some ways, isn't it, really, when you think about it? But then to actually champion it, and I'm sure you'd probably see now there's some success stories which you actually can really go, well, hang on, we've actually shown something here. And once we see the success stories, other people then much more likely to jump in on it. Is that been your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think the point about supporting the entrepreneurs is so important, because if you think most entrepreneurs, most businesses So 40 to 80% failure rate of new businesses starting, and the resilience and mindset that entrepreneurs have, and that ability to be completely agile is such a strength in a world that's changing so rapidly right now. I think everyone has to have a much more entrepreneurial mindset. But you're exactly right. Once you can see that success, and once you can see the impact, it builds and builds and builds. So we put sort of measures in place to support entrepreneurs, entrepreneurs generally, which was about mindset, our accelerators. And we found that the survival rate of businesses going through our accelerators increased from 40% to 80% after 2 years. We also found by creating the right environment, we would encourage more women to start businesses. So, you know, we saw a tenfold increase in the number of women starting and scaling businesses as a result of putting the right support in place. And those, you know, all of the actions that we put in place, there wasn't just one thing. I described it as a non-competitive sport. We used to share all of the things in the bank that we did with all the other banks, with all the other institutions, to encourage more people to come into that ecosystem to create the right environment. And it snowballed, and as it was working, more people wanted to see how it was working. And I think the more you can demonstrate success, the more people will be keen to follow. And I think, you know, no shame in being a fast follower. I think that's great. If you can have an impact on the whole ecosystem, then that's a real positive.
Yeah. We get to learn the mistakes of others, from others, really, don't you? That's the benefit of it. And it's, you know, there's you know, one of the lines in the arena, there's no effort without error or shortcoming. You know, that's one of the ideas from the speech in the arena, which we've sort of modeled this concept on, is, and if you get to bring your mistakes into the room as an entrepreneur and get to share them, and I think we overemphasize the competitive nature of most businesses in my experience as well. But, the good ideas, and we're in a great learning environment now. One of the questions I was going to ask you as a follow-up to that, how much of the role did you play in supporting people as leaders, you know, beyond sort of the good idea, beyond, you know, all of a sudden they've gone from, you know, the metaphor or the ideal or the sort of the thinking is, you know, someone in their lounge room or their garage through to now I'm employing people and having to put in place, you know, dealing with, particularly as it relates to organisations which may be growing quickly or actually dealing with, you know, the setbacks that will inevitably come their way. How much of the work was actually related to leadership?
Yeah, it was a huge amount to do with leadership. And I think the point you made there, which is a hugely important one, is that comfort of the learning experience, the triumphs and the failures. I always think whenever I talk as a leader that it's the things that have gone wrong, that have been challenging, that have been the most interesting and turbocharging parts of my career rather than the successes. But a huge amount of the work with entrepreneurs was about leadership and also what skills you need at different points. You know, having a great idea in a garage versus employing your first people to then needing to employ, you know, going from 2 people to 20 people to 100 people to 1,000 people, you need different skills, and those transitions are often the really difficult point. So a lot of what I would do with the entrepreneurship support would be talking about leadership or actually connecting other entrepreneurs together to talk about their leadership. People, particularly women, but I think all entrepreneurs and business leaders want relatable role models. And I think that relatability is really important, and the authentic experience. If you just get someone who comes and says, when you just get someone who comes and tells you all the wonderful aspects of the story and how the path was perfect and brilliant and, you know, this epitome of amazing success, it's interesting, but it's very little that you can take from it. Whereas when things go wrong, or the challenges or the hiccups or the transition points in leadership, I think those are where we talked about it a lot. And I think those are the really interesting things. And I think for me as well, on my leadership journey, those transition points from being a member of a team to, you know, leading my first team to leading a global team to, you know, and the challenges I've faced on those different points are definitely what shaped me as a leader, and seeing those journeys with other people, I think, as well.
It's interesting, just even the concepts around error. And because I spent majority of my working life in elite sport, we embrace the mistake as the opportunity for growth. That's an embedded part of the whole process, really. And we're able then to do that in terms of the off-field team, the business of sport as well. And so the concept is you need to be able to bring your errors into the room. If you're not prepared to do that, you're almost not entitled to be in this room. And the New Zealand All Blacks, one of the most successful sporting teams of all time, they have their line is, we carve our mistakes into the wall, because why would we want people who follow us to make the same errors as us? And the interesting concept around, I think, sort of entrepreneurship is there's embedded risk taking in it. And the majority of things which sort of pull us up in life are some form of fear or a little bit of laziness, perhaps. But mostly, I think the entrepreneurs probably hasn't, they've probably overcome the lazy piece, you know, to actually do what they're actually doing. And so you're able then to draw on your own experiences of that. Were you someone who could operate with that sort of candor as a CEO, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a choice that you make as a CEO to do that. I mean, I think authenticity as a leader is really important. And, you know, I think often there's a, particularly in the corporate world, there is this, you know, cult of CEO. You've got to be this all-knowing, infallible sort of leader. And I think that's a very sort of old style leadership model. Whereas, you know, I've always been a leader that you learn through experience, and you share the experience and you build on the experience, good and bad. And certainly when I became an executive and then the CEO, what I was trying to drive was a culture of experimentation and positive competitiveness. And I think if you're going to drive experimentation, then you have to be candid. So I've always been very candid. I think you learn more by being the person in the room who asks the question that says, I don't know what you're talking about, or I don't understand how that works. Explain that to me. It breaks down some of the hierarchy that naturally exists around these senior roles. But also being very candid about the mistakes I've made. I think humanizing leadership and making it acceptable for people to talk about mistakes, because I don't think it's the mistake that defines you. That was always my message. It's not, everybody makes mistakes, whether they talk about them or not. It is not the mistake that defines you. It is how you respond to the mistake or the error or the failure or the learning experience and what you do with it that defines you. And that's how I always used to talk about the errors I made, and I would bring them to life in examples of, you know, different points of my career when I did something and then what I did with that and then how that shaped me. I think that type of courageous leadership is really, and honest leadership is really important, because mistakes happen, and if you don't create a culture and environment where people can talk about them, learn from them, get the experience from other people, then those mistakes stay hidden, and that's bad culture and bad for the learning experience.
Yeah, it's interesting because you used the word courage then, and I often think about authenticity as an outcome, you know, that I experience you as authentic. You know, your intention may be to be authentic, but I only get to experience you as authentic if you're firstly prepared to be vulnerable, and there's no vulnerability without courage, like in any form, you know, and, you know, on a sporting field or, you know, in a boardroom, you know, in that sense. And but there is a danger of shame sort of kicking in as well, or opportunism kicking in as well, if you haven't built the type of culture that you're talking about, where if that's not part of who we are. And it's interesting you you talked right from the very start about choosing jobs or selecting jobs on the basis of what it would give you. And so was this right from the outset, you felt that your roles needed to give you something a little bit deeper in this way, beyond, you know, obviously the very important role you played in regard to the economy, in regard to the world, in regard to, you know, if you're not putting your stuff out there as a bank in a good way, well, the thing stops working properly, you know, as the world discovered at one point. And was that always something there for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think you always come with your own sort of values and, you know, history and dynamics and all the things that make you as a sort of leader, and then that gets shaped by the experiences that you have. But for me, you know, it's always been about the impact that you can have. I think certainly when, you know, I come from the financial services sector, so I've seen that the impact that an organization can have when it goes wrong, financial crisis, you know, affected huge numbers of people's lives and businesses. But I can also therefore see the impact of when you do it right. And I think any business leader, any business has no right to exist. It has to be relevant. It has to be relevant to its customers, to its employees, its, you know, its role wherever it sits, in whether it's a small business in a community or a global business in the global economy. So I've always been conscious of the importance of what role you play and the impact that you can have. I think a little bit like leadership, leaders leave a long shadow. You've got to be very conscious of what your impact is. And I think as a CEO of a large business, you know, the thing that's always been very important to me is I sit in a seat for a very short period of time. These businesses, the business I ran was 300 years old. So your job as a leader is to be part of a team, to drive direction and make sure that you hand the seat over in a better shape. But the shadow that your business leaves Incredible. And the impact that it has to be long-term and has to have value and be relevant. Otherwise, there's no reason why any business should exist. So it's always been important to me to think about what I'm learning, what I can get out of it, what motivates me, and also what impact I can have. And that's always been a key driver for me.
You talked about your values. Where did they come from, and did they change over time? And how conscious were you on having your own sort of personal principles around how you intended to lead, or, you know, how you sought to lead in that way?
Yeah, I think my values, you know, my come a lot from my background and my family. I come from a military family. I always used to say, even you know, when I was CEO, I was the least interesting person around, you know, the dinner table with my broader family. They were sort of doing military roles and having impact. So my values come from, like anyone, from my upbringing, and then are shaped by the environment. I think as you start your career, you're exposed to multiple different impacts and influences, different leaders. A great thing about the role I had at one point was I was working with four or five different managing directors when I was more junior, and you get to see leadership in all its forms. And, you know, at that stage, I didn't have any female role models. And so you have to decide, I think, based on what you see, what you learn and your values, what type of leader you want to be. And different events shaped that for me. And so, you know, one of the key principles for me, particularly as a woman in a very male dominated environment, which the financial services was that I had to do it on my own terms and my own principles. It's the advice I always give to people starting out in their career. Don't try and be someone else, be yourself, and then, you know, operate and be successful in your own right. So I think, you know, always had my values, but then it's shaped by the experiences you have in life, the environment you have, the people you surround yourself by. you know, I'm naturally a very competitive person. I naturally want to succeed, but do it in the right way with integrity. And also for me, it's always about the team. You win and lose as a team. So having the right type of culture and the right type of team, I think, is really important. So all those elements shape you, as the same way as the mistakes do, as the people you come across. And I think leadership is a choice. I think every day you choose to be a particular type of leader. You choose, you know, there are different paths you can go down. And I think that experience shapes you.
Did your competitiveness ever require you to cool your jets at any time?
Oh, always. Always. You always want to go faster than sometimes you need to. And occasionally there were the times where you just had to, you know, learn and take your time and build your skills. What is the great phrase? It's a marathon, not a sprint. You know, I was always wanting to sprint, and occasionally you just have to pace a little bit. I like winning. I want to be part of a winning team, and occasionally you just had to, you know, do a bit of time, figure out different things. So yeah, there were always moments where you get deeply frustrated, and you have to recalibrate, get a bit of perspective, and, you know, invest in your skills a little bit sometimes.
Yeah, and sometimes the scoreboard's not very obvious, is it? Particularly in a multifaceted, complex, layered environment. So I often wonder in those times where, you know, are you measuring outcomes, or are you measuring behaviours? You know, what is it that you're seeking to measure in those moments? You know, particularly where, you know, you've got a team of people. Basically, one of my favourite quotes in Australian football, we have the ball in our hand, is the most important person in the team is the one with the ball in their hand. And as CEO, it's rarely in your hands. You're always putting it in the hands of other people. Or in football terms, your football is at the feet of other people. And how does that play out for you in terms of your natural drive for success?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. You have to measure it in outcomes, and you have to be really, really clear what outcomes you want to measure. And I also think you have to look at the team success. I mean, the thing about being a CEO, when you win, it's the team's success. When you lose, it's the CEO's fault. So you have to recognize that your role is to allow other people to be successful and to shine, because it is the collective. But I think being really clear about what success is and what outcomes you're measuring are really important. It's very, very easy to get distracted by measuring the wrong things or other people's perceptions. You know, and as you know, sometimes things just don't go your way, despite the best efforts, the best people, the best outcomes. Something will come from left field. Someone will get a lucky break and win when, you know, you feel you should. And so being able to have that resilience and perspective, I think the most important role in either in the early part of your career or, you know, whether you're a CEO, is perspective, because it's that ability to zoom back out and go, is this a win or loss? Is this just a step in the path? Does this really matter? Is really important. And as CEO, you've got your eyes on the 10-year horizon, the 5-year horizon, and what's right in front of you. Everybody's got eyes on what's right in front of you. So perspective, resilience, recognizing sometimes things aren't fair, you know, that's just life, and making sure you're measuring the right outcomes. And, you know, I think sometimes there's huge dignity that you have to have in losing well as winning well. And I think that's a really important aspect that business needs to remember, as well as you see it in sport all the time. But I think that's really important.
And I think sport's grown up a fair bit like that. And, you know, we one of the terms we use is winning shallow versus winning deep. You know, are we prepared to win deep here? And winning deep is then going into those sorts of conversations around how we want to be, how do we want to win here? On what basis do we want to win? And to be fair to say, at different times I failed that test, you know, because there was the immediacy of, you know, of a victory which felt good at the time, but it wasn't going to play out well ultimately. And they're the hard lessons, aren't they, in that yeah. sense? And that's where perhaps having someone with a little bit of wisdom just reminding you of those moments, you know, as you're coming through the system is really helpful. I'm really interested in how you established a good team dynamic within your executive group. I always found that to be one of the most challenging aspects of being the CEO, as in I had a group of really strong-minded people with an obvious bias towards their own areas, and how you manage to bring the best out in them.
Yeah, I think managing a team and creating the right team is incredibly important. So I took, and particularly in, and it would be the same with sport, but within business, you know, you've got very high performing individuals, generally high egos, and, you know, and it can be a very individualistic kind of culture if you're not careful. And so for me, it was always about bringing the right team with the right culture, sort of on a common mission. I think that's really important, and being able to align that. And you know, you have to get the team dynamic working. One of the sports I used to play was I used to cox rowing teams, and the way I used to describe it is you'd have eight, you know, highly competitive individuals in a boat, and if you got them all moving at the same way, this boat would sing and it would fly. It would be, you know, it was amazing, and you could tell the difference between when it was working and when it wasn't. But each of those individual people had to be motivated in a different way, and that's true of corporate teams. So for me, it was, you know, the thesis I always used to have and have always had on the multiple teams I've built through my career: always hire people better than you. I think it's really important that you hire the best people. Sign a weak leader is when you push talent down. So you should never be intimidated by talent. You hire the best people, people who are better than you, because you want collective skills in your team. You definitely don't want everybody who looks the same, sounds the same, from the sound background, with the same thinking. So you want people who are going to have different points of view, different perspectives, because that's going to stop groupthink. It's going to allow people to be competitive. So hire people better than you. Be very clear on the culture that you want to create. So mutual respect is really important. And creating a team that can build trust and therefore have what I would describe as good fights. And for me, that is, you know, people will approach a problem from very different perspectives based on where their starting point is. And that's, you know, and have obscure ideas, and being able to allow people to disagree without it becoming personal. So, and the way you do that is you build trust and respect. That means people can fall out. That means you can have the best ideas and you can challenge each other. You want constructive challenge. But then when you walk out the door, you walk out the door as a team. So the final part of that equation is you win and lose as a team. So we used to have something that we call Colosseum rules, that you have your fight in the Colosseum, but you walk out the door as a team with the direction you're going. And then the final piece is, you know, when you make decisions, they've got to be based on data and facts, not emotion. Emotion does come into it and perspective comes into it, but data and facts. But then also recognizing that if you get it wrong, you course correct really quickly, and you understand the risks of the decision you're making, and there's no blame culture. So people are then very comfortable to be able to come back and say, we tried this, it didn't work for this reason, and they don't suddenly get eviscerated. And so that was always how I tried to build the teams. It's a really hard juggling act because you've got high performing individuals trying to come collectively as a team. But that's where you drive that. And then for me, it was very much creating the environment where people could have that safe debate, that environment where they could safely win and lose. There was no humiliation. If someone was underperforming, they would never be brought to task in front of everyone. That would be, you know, we would do that together. So mutual respect, constructive challenge, you know, a performing, high performing culture, and willingness to sort of learn and fail and accept risk. With risk comes failure. And then at the end of the day, as the leader, I stood in front of them. So if we won, the team won. If we lost, you know, I stood in front of them, and that was the approach I took. And I think that's how you get the best out of people and avoid groupthink and competitive dynamics and, you know, that winning culture. And that concept of, as I described it with my sporting analogy, getting the boat really singing so that you were getting the best out of everybody individually and collectively. And when you have those high performance teams really working, it's great.
Yeah, I'm pleased you've used the rowing metaphor. There's a great rowing team here called the Awesome Foursome many years ago, and one of their lines was always, does it make the boat go faster? You know, basically every activity, every conversation they had, doesn't make the boat go faster. And I think that's as good a summary, by the way, I've ever seen of anyone wanting to lead an executive team. And there's a couple of, you know, really cool ideas in regard to this. I wouldn't mind just, you know, going back over, which is, you know, obviously, you know, the idea of hiring people better than you. And I'd be really interested in what you look for people in that process, you know, as in particularly when coming into such a senior level within the organisation, the idea of winning and losing as a team. And one which you talked about, which is alignment, is that, you know, I would always focus, and certainly talk to this a lot now, is agreement versus alignment. We're not going to agree here, you know. Agreement, we actually, if we're all agreeing, the chances are we're not digging into or dealing with the challenge that this ambiguous circumstance or situation is throwing at us, and that's really what we should be dealing with. But I'm really interested in, particularly at that very senior level, is what attributes you sought from the people who would come into this room, would be a part of this critical decision-making group.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're putting a team together, it's the most it's one of the most important things that you can do as a leader, I think, bringing that group of people together. And I would look at a number of different things. And also, it's not static as well. It's the right type of leader for the right time. You know, in defining the strategy and the vision for the business that I had, there were certain skills that I need and certain dynamics that I needed. And those can evolve. So some people, you know, I'd be bringing in for a very specific task. You know, I needed to build a particular business in a particular way, and I would need that skill set for a particular period. So I think whenever you're bringing your team together, and certainly how I looked at it, was what was it we wanted to achieve? What type of skills would we need? So the strategy, the vision, and the mix, did I need more, you know, stable, traditional people, or did I need innovators and, you know, disruptors to help drive me? So I think understanding the context in which you are bringing a team together really helps you think about it. So I think that the strategy and the vision is the first thing. The second is you're hiring them, you know, individually to run businesses and collectively to sit across your primary team. So it's the skills they need for the particular business that they're going to run, of which they're part of. And then the collective, is that culture going to fit? And so I think it's always that balance and where you are in the evolution and the circumstances, and recognizing that may change. And then it's really thinking about you don't want a team full of, as I would describe them, innovators and disruptors. If your whole team is disruptors, you'll never get anything done. So there's a balance between the nature of the team that you would bring together. Who are the peacemakers? Who are the disruptors? Who are the people you're going to need to fit together? So it's a bit of a jigsaw puzzle as well, but you're hiring for skills, you're hiring for strategy, and then it's the mix that you make up. You know, and I've had situations before where you know, I've had a choice between someone who is utterly brilliant at what they do, you know, very, very good, but culturally not a fit. And so therefore what you could achieve as a team would be knocked off course. So you're having to weigh off the pros and cons of how that individual can contribute individually and then collectively. So it's always a bit of a jigsaw puzzle. So that was always what I would do. But I think as a leader, you also have to recognize your own skills and to make sure you're filling in gaps. What don't I have on this team? Do I not have a disruptor? Do I not have a peacemaker? How does it fit together? So that was really what I would do. And I think what's really important as a leader today, the world is moving so quickly, whether it's technology, whether it's geopolitics, whether it's social trends. You have to be mindful of the environment and what you need, and therefore it's never static. So unfortunately, the job of the CEO, which sometimes makes it pretty lonely, is you are having to think 3-5 years ahead, and what do I need now, what will I need differently, and when something blows up. You know, I hadn't planned on, nor had anyone, COVID. You know, some of my team weren't the right team to lead us through COVID, and that was some of the changes you have to make. So I think being agile, thinking about the collective skills, you know, the contribution, and being really comfortable having people who are not like you working for you. You want that, you said the point, agreement rather than alignment. You don't want people all to agree with each other, because if you're all sitting there going, oh, this is the best idea in the world, you can almost be certain that you've missed something. So you want that natural friction and challenge, but in a constructive way to help you get the best out of everything.
When you had to make a choice to change someone because the mix of the team just needed changing, just that little, I see we're more this than that, you served us well in this time, but we need now more of this. How did you wake up each morning to that challenge?
Yeah.
No, because it sits with you. That's all on you in that moment. How did you personally cope, you know, with some of the, you know, the deeper, you know, I'm going to have to change someone's life today. How did you manage that personally?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the toughest things. I think as a leader, you have to, if those decisions ever become easy, you need to stop right away. You have to maintain your humanity and integrity and empathy. I think it's really important. I think the job as the CEO is, you know, you are building for the long term, and you're responsible for, well, in my case, millions of customers and, you know, thousands of employees. And so it's about driving for the long-term outcome. And so you always have to keep your eye on that. Where it is then, you know, someone who has done a brilliant job for you, because it's never personal. It's never, very rare you're asking someone to step aside because they've done a terrible job. It's normally because they've done a right job at the right time, but you need something different for the future. I think for me, it's always about making sure you're being, you know, acting with integrity, always acting with empathy and respect, and treating people well, you know, as they join you and as they leave you. Not everybody does that. I think it's, for me, how I reconciled that was always about making sure, you know, I was very open and honest. I was very clear. I dealt with people with respect, and I treated them with respect as they moved on in the next stage of their career or joined in that period. But that's it. It's horrible. It's, you know, it's never easy. It shouldn't be easy. These are people's careers and their lives and their families. And so you've got to keep an eye on you know, what is the important objective, but then treat people with respect as you would expect to be treated. I always say to every leader, at some point you will be sitting on the wrong side of the desk when these things happen, and you must behave with dignity and integrity and empathy. And that's always been the way. But the moment those decisions become easy, you should stop, because they should never be easy.
It's a really interesting take, isn't it, that you know, as much as it's hard for you to be the person delivering on that, and, you know, as long as, you know, you've got to be able to back it up, and I understand that, it's much harder for the other person. And it is, I think sometimes, you know, if you at least try to walk in their shoes, and it's one of those, I often think, the first question I often ask myself, have I coached this person well enough? That's often the first question I'll ask. The second question I ask, have I supported this person well enough through their journey? And the third question is there something in their life which might be getting in the road of whatever we need from them at this point? And life's complicated, and we understand that. It's only after you've gone through steps 1, 2, and 3 do you then say, well, we might have the wrong person here. And it took me a long time to get to 1, 2, and 3. I and it's interesting, you used the word blame before, is, you know, we don't, you know, we can't have that concept around, you know, a blame culture. But when things go wrong, it's looking for something to blame, isn't it? The words, it needs that, you know, that lightning rod in those moments. And as a CEO and as a leader, to try and be better than that in that moment is, you know, is that draws on every part of your fortitude, I think.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And look, things, you know, I think, you know, when things do go, if people behave badly with lack of integrity and then, you know, you take very swift action. If in an evolution of a strategy, it's just you need different skills and different talent, it's really important. But I think your point around coaching is really critical. One of the things that, you know, I've always said, you've got to be really clear when people are performing or underperforming. Have you been really clear around what their job is? Have you given them the skills to do their job? Have you coached them to do their job? Have you given them feedback? You've got to go through all those steps. And it's really important that leaders do that with their teams. If you haven't done all of that and something's gone wrong, then you as a coach, you know, as a leader, have responsibility for what's happened. So I think it's, you know, that player coach concept in business is really important. But I sort of do the repeat mantra. Are we clear what we need to do? Are we clear what we're measuring? Okay. And then check in. Is it working? Is it not working? What have we missed? I think this kind of continuous playback is really important to give everyone a fair shot. And you know what? Sometimes it doesn't work and people need to move on. But you've got to be really clear on expectations, outcome, training, support, and feedback loop.
It's interesting. You used leadership and coach almost interchangeably there, leader and coach. Did you see yourself as a coach, as leader?
Yeah, very much. Very much so. I think, you know, a lot of my job with my team, you know, I was the leader and the CEO, but I was also coaching my team. So I was continually trying with my team to get the best out of them, to coach them, to give them feedback. You know, you have that as the CEO, the opportunity to see the interactions and help coach. Absolutely. I, you know, a big part of my job was to help them be absolutely the best that they could be and give them the best opportunity. And I think that's an important part. You know, I always used to say one of the first things I did when I took a new role, whether it was CEO or my previous role, was hire the team behind you who are going to replace you. You should be developing talent, nurturing talent, coaching people. Sometimes it's tough with really high performing teams, but yeah, your job is as a coach. And what you want is, you know, hire people better than you, hire your successors. That's what a good leader should do.
Can I have a quick chat? One of the interesting things, and one of the great challenges, I think, for any CEO, and we've got a lot of CEOs who will be listening to us with your experiences, is board relationship. I'd imagine that would be layered and complex in your world, and one of which, you know, can be really defining for CEOs, obviously. Particularly, you know, you've got the complexities of your team and getting high performance from within that group, all of whom, as you said, were running their own businesses, but you need them to be very much aligned to you and your group in that moment. And you've got, you know, often the board, I say it's the people with the least amount of knowledge and understanding, but from time to time have to make the most important decisions. You know, in your time as a CEO, how did you find that challenge in regard to that form of relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I think the relationship between the CEO and the chair and the board is I think probably one of the toughest things for CEOs to get their head around, because it's very different. The relationship between the CEO and chair is really important. And you as the CEO don't choose your chair. So you have to figure out how to work with them. What's a really interesting concept, I think, is remembering any new CEO that your board is not a team. They are a collection of individuals. And that was probably some of the best advice I got given when I became a CEO. You like to think of them as on the same path and as a team of individuals. They're not a team of individuals. They're a collective of a number of different people with their own agendas. They have their fiduciary and director responsibilities, but they are a selection of individuals and will be sitting on different boards and have different experience and come from different dynamics. So they can be very different. So thinking about how you engage with that board and understand them is quite important. And then the chair CEO role is very important. Understanding their motivation, their experience, you know, how you should interact with them, what is the rhythm, what is the communication, probably one of the most important things and time-consuming things to get right. And different chairs are very different. They're individuals and have their own quirks. But it's don't ever think of them as a team. They are a collective of individuals, and thinking about them in that perspective is quite important.
Yeah, it's a really interesting take, because I haven't thought of it like that, because I think if you ask them, they might not necessarily agree, as in they would see themselves as being a team in that way. But it's almost impossible for them to be a team given how little time they actually spend together, and as you mentioned, how often they just don't know each other. You know, they can't build a dynamic in their own right, just simply because of what a dynamic is. A dynamic requires to be created, you know, in that sense, and therefore, when it comes to how they measure performance, the danger is that it'll go straight to outcome and data and the things which are clearly more measurable, where from a CEO perspective, how you talk to your experience inside the organisation, as in what's really going on, particularly in that moment, during challenging phases or new strategic, you know, initiatives that you're looking, and you have to sell, you know, a big picture strategic idea, what the light is at the top of the hill, at a time when, by definition, they're mostly risk averse, because that's how they're going to be judged. You know, they are mostly judged when things go bad. They're rarely judged when things go well, in that sense, particularly in a bank, I would imagine. You know, that the judgments of boards and during the, you know, the global financial crisis, all of a sudden, you know, the spotlight did turn on them. And I would imagine that would have created even, I know certainly in Australia, it created a far more risk-averse mindset, which isn't necessarily the one that a CEO is looking for during a time of opportunity and growth.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think just, you know, understanding, you know, and different sectors will be different, but understanding your board dynamics, where your board members are coming from, what other boards they're sitting on, which may be having different challenges, you know, what they're interested in, what committees they chair. You know, it's you know, a, a lot of, particularly in a regulated industry, a lot of board work is very process regulatory. And so the things that, you know, one of the challenges I always had was with my management team, you know, they really wanted to talk about the business and the strategy and exciting things that they were developing and investing in and forward looking. And board meetings would be very process, backward looking, risk. And so you were often having different conversations and different dynamics. And so, you know, really understanding that as a CEO around where your board sits, where your executive team sits, how the dialogue should work. My best advice is always your, which was the one I always had, is there should never be any surprises to the board. Always share bad news, even if you don't know the answer, because what you don't want is any surprises. You want, you know, to understand. And, you know, that can be difficult for a board. So setting the culture in which the executive team and the board will interact is quite important. But that's where your chair becomes, you know, very important in terms of managing how that rhythm should work. But yeah, it takes up a lot of time as a CEO, probably more than you realize when you take the job.
Would you be prepared as CEO to bring forward the problem without your possible solution to it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about sort of transparency. I mean, as I think for anything I would always say to my team is, if there's a problem, don't just bring me problems, but bring me ideas on how we solve them. I think that's a really important dynamic with managing your executive team. Otherwise, the CEO becomes the postbox for all the bad news and give me the answer. I think for the board, there is a bit of, you don't just throw problems at them, but you're very transparent around what you're doing. One of the things I would do with my CEO update to my board would be, you know, effectively my board update would start with, here's the things that have gone well, here's the things that aren't going too well, here's the things that I'm worried about, and here's what the team are focusing on, you know, going forward. So they would have a view or insight into what I was worried about and what were concerns. I think, you know, sometimes you don't have the solution, but you're working through it. But given the board confidence that you're on top of issues is quite important. So it's not just a laundry list of problems. It's, you know, things you may be worried about that you're working on, and that builds good confidence with the board that you're on top of issues.
I think it's a really good way of approaching it. And unfortunately, I've had a few repressed memories just jump out at me at times. I didn't do that nearly well enough in my time as a CEO that, you know, perhaps I was a bit reluctant to bring forward some of the things that you know, there was, the football clubs in Australia are still membership based, and there's actually, they're democratically elected. They're like the old, we've managed to maintain that aspect of our sport, which is great. So we don't have private ownership, which means we compete on our merits, which has been a wonderful thing in Australian football. But the Murphy's Law of board meetings was that they tended to follow when you'd got beaten three games in a row. You know, they tended to be when you're actually performing at your worst. You know, so that was one of the things you had to contend with. And often these people were, you know, the one thing they were as invested as what anyone was in the outcomes of the team. And often it got there on the basis that they thought they could actually change things. So it could be a little bit of a tricky dynamic at different times. But it is, I think it's as complicated a dynamic that a CEO actually has to deal with. And so really almost establishing your rules of engagement, such as you did, and say, well, I will bring forward the problems, I will bring forward the issues as much as I know of them, and, you know, I can't bring forward the problem that I'm not aware of at this point, then you can debate whether you in fact think I should have been aware of it. That's a different conversation. You know, smell smoke, you know, see if there's a fire type mindset. But I think that approach is a really sound one. And because it is a complicated little piece, it's not complicated, it's complex. There's no actual absolute way of doing it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the one thing you always challenge in the sporting unit that you just gave an example of is you're always constantly balancing short term versus long term. My view as a, you know, as a CEO is you're trying to build long term value, you know, for the future. But that means you still have to deal with short-term value. And, you know, people, it's always a trade-off. You're dealing with multiple different stakeholders, some who are all focused on just only the short term and don't care about the future. You have other stakeholders who are all about the future and not about today. And it's a constant balance to get equilibrium, or the right balance, not equilibrium, the right balance between the short term and the long term. My very clear view as a CEO is you're there to build the long-term sustainable value of an organization for its people, its customers, its markets, its shareholders. But you've also got to deliver the short term as well. And it's always the balancing of those things.
Yeah, there's a lovely term, which the score will take care of itself if you are approaching it in that way. And that's an interesting one. I think when some of the, you know, there's two or three of those contradictions which I think CEOs have to operate in that space, which is one, short and long term is certainly one of the contradictions. They can cut across each other different. You know, the opportunistic aspect of, you know, short term parts can't be ignored because, you know, they're there. There's also, I think, the contradiction of risk taking as well. You know, to build something different to what the bank is today, it will be required to take a lot of risks, whereas a board in particular is risk averse for all the reasons that it perhaps should be risk averse. So that balancing of risk is often, they're in contradiction with each other. You know, you want to be an entrepreneurial organization. Well, hang on, we don't want to do that. It is, I'm sure you would have faced into that a lot. You know, that's, yeah. That would have been, you know, I often say to people, it's like having one foot on the pier and another foot on the boat. You just got to work out which one you're going with. You're going to jump on the boat. Well, you want to know who's sort of in charge of the boat, who's driving the boat, who's in charge of the boat. You also want to know how far you can swim because you might be jumping back out of the boat at some point. So there's some of these things often, that's the role of the CEO, I reckon,
yep.
is just being in that space often. Well, I've had a wonderful conversation and I've really appreciated the opportunity. I know it's early in the morning for you. Appreciate you getting out of bed and having a chat to from the other side of the country. It's been a real pleasure. It's been a very pure CEO type conversation. It'd be the sort of conversation, you'd be the sort of person I'd enjoy talking about the intrigue of just that unique little space that you've operated in, and certainly I did, and a lot of people who will listen to this podcast did. So it's been just a pleasure, you know, chatting to you, and I've enjoyed every moment, and the best of luck with the future. I know you're about to embark on a few new things which look really exciting for you, and I know that whoever finds themselves in your orbit at any time will be better for that experience, as we have been today. So thanks very much.
Oh, thank you. I've really enjoyed it as well. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.